Hello, everybody.
What up, what up, what up, what up?
I'm going to turn your mic up a little bit.
Hello, just trying to check if I'm redlining. All right, sweet, we're good.
Yeah, all right. This is Fascism Red Alert with Max and Med.
Hey, y'all.
It is a cold day here in Amherst, Massachusetts. It's a brutally cold day.
Lord have mercy, it's a cold day.
Apparently, it's going to get better here in the next week or so, but right now we are waiting on our guest. It's going to be Lena Deutsch. She's going to come here and enlighten us as to all things that are happening in her political life. But until then, I guess we're just going to sit here and bullshit. So, Med, why don't you tell people how you've been doing?
Well, let's think about it. I have a bone to pick. I have a bone to pick with every single person on this campus that thinks it's okay to tell me, you look tired. Are you okay? Motherfucker, I know I look tired! I woke up like this! Didn't mean to blow your fucking eardrums out, but like, goddamn, people, chill with that shit. You don't need to tell people they look tired. You can say, are you doing okay? That's really simple. That's really easy. You don't have to, like, imply the negative.
Or already. State the obvious.
Or state the obvious, too. Or state the obvious. I mean, we go to college, you know? Like, when do I not look tired? Like, when am I not on, like, 150 milligrams of caffeine? You know, smoking cigarettes to chill my nerves for a second? Like, when are people not in this state of pure tired exhaustion?
Especially right now, like, after spring break is over, like, halfway through last semester of the year, it's just, like, everybody's on this level. We all know.
We all know. It's that time of year. Did I tell you I thought it was 3 weeks until the end of school after spring break, before spring break?
I thought it was like four.
Yo, no, okay, but it's six, but like...
No, it's like four till the end of classes.
Oh yeah, four till the end of classes, yeah, and six until like leave. The end of things. Yeah.
Fuck.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I don't know.
Bum, 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 ba-na-na, na-na-na-na-na. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. I lined up a song if you want to put it on there.
Yeah.
Absol.
We'll get a little bit of Absol going on here. It's going to be Absol Evil Genius.
Miscellaneous. Used to make love to complex simplicity all the time. Now she my star and I'm her sky and I ain't afraid to die. I don't give a fuck. Mind, yo. 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 Indecisive, enlightening, frightening, idle with the light, sensitive eye, the tiger, fire, flame, die line, times five by the way, skydiving, tidal waves, writing rhymes and oxygen, scribing sonnets silently that inspire men and brightening environments that I have not been in. Obviously, opting not to sing songs in sobriety, subsiding the poison, imploding our society, functioning addicts with clammy hands, leaving my paraphernalia everywhere. Told Lori I never do coke again, but she did what she did, and I'm here again. I ain't pointing no fingers, I'm still a man. No, I'm more than that. You would know if you scroll through my older tracks. I'm just a Romeo, morning is Juliet. I didn't complete without new weed, and do me a favor and save all that Satan and shit. You pay, it's gonna pay for this shit. I studied theology, ancient philosophy, astronomy, astrology, the current state of the economy, Washington, D.C., fossils of dinosaurs, the origin of our species, monatomic gold, flowers grown in feces, Christ conscious, Paishan, mocking Jesus, the chicken came before the eggs, the thesis, I bet she's an evil genius, disobedient, villain you hate to love, mischievous, is mysterious, miscellaneous. Make love to complex simplicity all the time. Now she my star and I'm her sky and I ain't afraid to die. I don't give a fuck. Mine, yo. I don't give a fuck.
Hello, hello. All right, we are back again. We are here with our guest of the evening, Lena Deutsch.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's busy time of year.
That's fair. That's fair. Lean a little closer in there. There you go. What have you been up to this semester?
This semester, it's been a whirlwind. Right now, I'm trying to think about what my final topics are going to be, like, for my final papers. Sorry, that's not interesting.
No, that's fair. What class are you taking?
Well, right now I'm thinking specifically about my class at Smith called Authoritarianism in the Middle East. And I just thought of a way to combine my interests. So, like, doing, there's this, like, Arab youth movement in the Middle East on, like, climate change. Mm. And I was thinking about kind of analyzing their tactics and seeing just the ways in which they're going about the movement, because it's different everywhere.
That's fair.
So,
just to illuminate the people, what is it exactly that you study?
Sorry, yeah, I study, what do I say? I study peace in the Middle East through the lens of climate change, kind of like conflict resolution issues, if you will. I'm trying to, right now I'm looking at the Gulf nations, but I'm trying to move towards Israel, Palestine, Jordan. So,
what specifically are you interested in, Israel, Palestine, and Jordan?
Water.
Expand on that a little bit.
So they share, Israel, Palestine, Jordan share the Jordan River Basin as a large resource for their water usage, for drinking water, that is. And trying to think if, like, proper allocation and following through with the Oslo Accords would be more conducive to better relations between the nations and the peoples and the different ethnic groups within those nations.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. So how does your authoritarian class fit into this, your authoritarianism class?
Well, it's interesting because I've kind of realized that some people, my biggest takeaway right now is that some people are happy with the status quo and they don't want democracy. And here we are going about our business at Hampshire College thinking, oh, democracy is the way. It's about, am I going to use this word correctly? Democratizing?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Cool. Nice. Nations, and it's like, while I don't think authoritarianism is beneficial to most people, it's just the mindset that it's not exactly what others had envisioned either. So
that's fair.
Yeah.
Well, Leans, you are on fascism red alert, so you know we might just bring it back. What are your thoughts on authoritarianism since you're taking this class? Like, what are the things that kind of blew your mind about it? What are the things that you found interesting? Like, tell us about that.
The ways it's manifesting here in the U.S. too, especially with the new administration. And I say that because patronage is a huge highlight in authoritarianism, mm-hmm. and lack of job diversity, lack of jobs, while also trying not to have a restless male age group of like 18 to 28. So right now, especially because of the changes that the U.S. is going through, and has been always going through, but specifically being highlighted since Trump's presidency, It's just there's so many parallels to be drawn, and not to say everything is the same or that's totally comparable, but there are some, like, eerie similarities.
What are the things that stick out to you the most?
That stick out to me the most, it's the idea. Well, first of all, I said patronage first because I think that's part of what it was. And who your patrons are and what your relationship looks like and the trust that comes in with patronage.
Can you break that down a little for us? Just, you know, in terms of accessibility, something like language. Like, tell me about patronage. I'm, like, slightly confused on the word and the usage.
Right. So, I mean, I'm no expert at all. I'm still in this class, still learning. For me, patronage is, like, the relationship between, say, a business owner and the person that goes to buy from that business. Or even, you could even apply that concept to, like, the government and what that gives to you and what you give to them. Anyway, that kind of manifests, I consider patronage.
And you were talking about, like, that being a, like, key part of this institutional shift that we're experiencing and a key part of the formulation of, like, authoritarian governments. And I can see the connection, but can you draw it out for me a little bit?
Sure. So, okay. So, basically, when there's – I think what I'm trying to speak to right now, I'm a little – frazzled to say, but I think it's mostly like the idea of trust and the idea of like consistency and a commitment and within a relationship, and just trusting that your best interest will be held. So like you won't think that if you keep going to this one grocery store that they're going to raise the prices on you just because they can, as opposed to they will because they can. I'm sinking in this chair right now, sorry. So that's what's been highlighted for me. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on any of this or like?
No, I thought it was really interesting when you first mentioned it, especially when you kind of went into your definition of patronage. Especially seeing as our current, you know, I'm not going to call him a president. our current authoritarian leader is a businessman, and that was, you know, the base of his campaign. And a lot of people, you know, their main rhetoric was around the fact that I trust him because he's not a politician. He's not a lifelong politician. He's not a careered politician. He's a businessman. He's going to work in the interests of business and small business and large business. And because I know that he's going to work in that interest, I trust him. So like speaking to that and like that's what resonated with me the most when hearing you discuss that.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because you know, EPA just lost 30% of its funding, right? So it's like, well, 30% of funding, what does that mean in jobs? You know, you're telling us, oh, there'll be more jobs. America will be great again. Well, where are those people going to go? Like, where do you expect them to go? Are they going to have more jobs that you want them to have? So there'll be a lack of diversity in employment? Like, not race or ethnicity, but, like, the jobs itself, you know? Like, what does that say to our government and to our people in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think it's also really interesting, with, just on the patronage thing, sort of, like, the direct line of communication that Trump has had with various business leaders and various industries. And it's traditionally like blue collar white industries. So you see, right at the end of the campaign, he had that whole thing with the air conditioning manufacturer in Mexico, where they were going to move a factory to Mexico or something like that. And he directly like called them out on Twitter or something like that. And they ended up like keeping their factories here. And he's done a lot of stuff like that with the auto industry. I know Ford was like specifically targeted for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it is really interesting because it is obviously the construction of this patronage network, but it's the construction of the patronage network like specifically targeting a certain group of people. And that group of people is the white working class. You know what I mean? Whether or not what he's doing is actually going to help their like material situations and stuff like that, you can tell that he's specifically targeting those industries that are at least perceived to be the backbone of that class of people in this country. So
for sure.
A friend of mine, Jack Polston, awesome guy. If you ever meet him, you have met an awesome human being. And I were discussing something earlier today, actually, around the authoritarian leadership. And we were discussing the fact that this man is old, y'all.
Yeah, he really is. He really is. But you know what's also interesting? Like, speaking, like, completely, like, transparently, something about him doesn't seem as old, too, at the same time. Do you all feel that, too? Like, he is really old, and in many ways, in complete ways, his mindset and the frameworks that he works in are all old frameworks. Mm-hmm. But he presents himself and acts younger than he really is, which I think is part of why he also got elected.
I agree. I totally agree. He does, like, he doesn't, he plays and performs youth very well. And
yeah.
You would expect him to be in his, like, you know, late 50s, early 60s, exactly. Something like that. But this man's 70.
No,
he's
yeah.
the oldest running, I mean, sorry, he's the oldest president that sat in that seat for a long, long time, like, all the way back to, like, the 1800s. And, like, thinking about, like, how, I'm not saying that, like, your age, like, you're being in the elderly, being in mm-hmm. an older phase of your life necessarily is going to affect, like, your ability to process things, how you act, what you react to things. But, like, there are certain aspects of his, you know, just general comportment that, like, I really, like, I don't know. Like, that's, like, some old people shit to do.
It's true. Like, and then you look at Bernie Sanders, who is also of the right. same age, and he's the complete opposite, where his delivery is very old, but his frameworks are, I mean, he's still he's learning and unlearning a lot of things at the same time, but it's way younger and, like, resonated clearly with our, like, millennial generation. Heavy. But real.
Heavy indeed.
Have y'all heard about these terrorist attacks in London?
No, wait, I haven't. What happened?
I have. It was it was a similar attack. This happened today. It was right outside the Parliament. It was on that. It was Westminster Bridge, I believe it was. But it was similar to the attacks in Nice and then in Berlin, respectively, on Bastille Day and then the Christmas Market, where it was like, you know, a car was like driven through a group of people, and I think the statistic was. I think it was 20 injured, 3 dead. Two of the dead were civilians that were run over. One of the dead was a police officer that was stabbed by the person after he like got out of the car. But already been claimed as a terror attack, even though nobody's taken responsibility for it. I mean, I don't know. This happened today. It's still pretty unclear as to how it's all going to pan out. But I don't know. Maybe to start like a longer conversation, it's scary to me looking forward how these attacks are going to start to get spun by these, you know, as we get farther right-wing governments in power. Like, obviously we have that right now in the UK, not to the extent that we have it in the US, but I mean their administrative branch changed after Brexit and Tony Blair stepped down, so I'm sure that there's going to be some kind of reactionary something coming out of that country.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that this is probably only going to further inflame Le Pen in France, and I'm sure that, you know, the Trump administration is going to latch onto this in a pretty hardcore way. But, I mean, there was also a new ban coming out of the UK on, like, portable electronics going on aircraft. Did you hear about this?
No.
No?
I started thinking about, like, the Note 7 exploding on the plane. Sorry, I know it's not what you're probably talking about, but...
No, it's weird. It's, like, it's sort of in line with the Muslim ban here in this country in the sense that it targets... Muslim majority, like Arab states, but pretty much what it is you can't carry on any electronic device that's not a mobile phone onto a plane. So like, and they target a lot of Gulf states in that too, which is, I don't know, slightly different than what's happening in this country, but like UAE and Saudi targeted in that. But yeah, you can't like have a laptop or something like that. It's over fears that this specific bomb maker in Yemen who works for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula apparently has the capability to turn those things into bombs or weapons or something like that. But, I mean, just an excuse to...
I just, whenever these things come up, I just wonder, like, where are the boundaries in these situations? Like, when is it a matter of paranoia, and when is it a matter of practicality and safety and national security? And that's a bigger question, and that's like a...
Bring it on.
I can speak to that. So, when we get into that space of, like, when is it... like an actual question of people's security, like protecting lives, making sure that quote unquote, like people who were intending to harm innocent folks don't get access to the ability to do so. You kind of get to a very, very subjective conversation about what exactly is security, who is secure, who gets to be safe. Because, you know, just because white people in their white suburban communities or, you know, rich people of color in their communities aren't necessarily going to be targeted by these, like, quote-unquote radical Islamist extremists. Like, that doesn't change the fact that, like, other folks within the country are experiencing different forms of violence. And, like, these folks who are experiencing different forms of violence that aren't related to these, like, quote-unquote terrorist threats, that's still violence. They're still not safe.
Right.
And that's violence that's, you know, enacted by the state. That's the violence enacted by the very organization that's supposed to, like, give you safety to some degree, give you like basic human, like basic humanity, because, you know, it's supposed to like recognize you to some extent as a part of it, as a part of like it that lives and exists and needs to have sustenance.
Yeah.
So like, in terms of when is it paranoia and when is it actually about national security, you have to understand that it's always paranoia and it's always about national security, because national security is invested in maintaining the dynamics as they are. And the dynamics as they are that the immigrants who are coming into this country who are brown are a threat to you and will either, you know, economically disempower you or physically hurt you and the people you love. And they only want to do that because you're white or because, you know, you're American, however you're identified. And that's the paranoia aspect to it. That's the whole, like, everybody is included in this general category. It's like that, and I'm not trying to be, like, hella academies here, but, like, this political philosopher Foucault talks about biopower. That's the understanding that, like, my survival or my community's survival is dependent on the death of other communities and other people. So if they lose, if they're dying, if they have a famine, I'm winning because their loss is my win. So that's the concept. And that's what's being applied here. Like, the understanding that we must, like, literally identify certain folks as the enemy at all times, like, they are inherently suspicious, that is... Oh, God, now I'm, like, getting way into it.
I'm here for it.
Basically, there is no distinction. It's always about paranoia. National security isn't, like, the actual security of the citizens. It's not the actual security of the people. It's the security of the state. It's the security of the state's, you know, jurisdiction over things. It's the justification of the state's violence and its actions. Because as soon as there isn't paranoia, there's space to critique the state. Mm-hmm. And as soon as there's space to critique the state, people, you know, really get into it. And, like, when they're not being represented, people are pissed the hell off. So as a means to make sure that that doesn't occur, the state has to produce and, you know, manufacture certain types of fears and play off of those fears. So it's always going to be about paranoia. It's always going to be this sort of, like, hypersensitivity to, like, a, like, non-existent threat that's created. I mean, it's existent. People died, obviously, today. But, like, what kind of threat is, you know, the threat of a quote-unquote radical Islamist terrorist attack, something that happens, like, once or twice a year in, like, Western countries, compared to, like, the fact that, you know, 12% of children in America are starving.
Yeah.
Like, how is that not violence?
Right.
Like, that's a lot more people. That's literal children, you know. Like, mm-hmm. That's violence. They're dying. They're, like, why are we not paranoid about that? Because it's not brown people killing them. So, yeah. Long story short, there is no difference.
That was really well said. Something that I was thinking about earlier today, and that should have been a no-brainer, like, to me. No, I mean, it's not so much a question as is like a just like finally like being able to put it to words that, like, with, like, this, like, quote Muslim ban and, like, the quote immigration reform or what have you, whatever terms you feel most comfortable using, like, it's you're targeting brown people, and there's so many white immigrants in this country too, you know, and they're not, it's not as, like, if you will, like, quote, easy to tell that they're immigrants too. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, are they taking our jobs? Like, do you still consider a white person taking your job? It's almost like I literally have to question that. And then it's so fucked up.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, like, and, like, let's really, really, like, delve into it, talk about it. Like, let's talk about this quote-unquote Muslim ban. Because it's not a Muslim ban. Like, it's not banning Muslims. It's banning people from particular areas of traveling into here.
Right.
People who are getting kicked off of flights, like Middle Easterners who are getting kicked off of flights, are Christian Libyans, are Sikhs, are, you know, Jewish Jordanians. They're brown people who are read as brown, understood as brown when people see them, therefore understood as a threat. But they're not Muslims. They're not directly related to them. Not necessarily, at least. But, like, it's not about the ideology of Muslims. It's not about the religion. It's not about who ascribes this particular, you know, ideology. There's white Muslims in this country who exist perfectly fine and are protected by their whiteness. It's about the fact that these people are brown and that in everybody's associations, brown inherently means threat.
Right.
I think there's also something to be said about the need to create sort of, like, the other in order to justify, like, certain kinds of authoritarianism taking hold in this country, to go back to the whole authoritarian conversation. But in doing that, nuance is not required, right? Nuance is sort of frowned upon in the creation of these kinds of ideologies. And therefore, like, what you're saying about
the whole like white Muslim thing, like that doesn't it doesn't fall into this, you know what I mean? And like Christian Libyans like getting kicked off of planes, like it doesn't matter. Like it's just you need a target. You know who the target is when you see it. That's what this kind of ideology needs to survive. If it doesn't have that, then it's exactly what you were saying before. The paranoia starts to seep away and people are able to maybe actually question, you know, what's actually happening. But I think personally, you know what I mean? People are fearful. You know what I mean? Like it just matters what you direct their fear at. And a lot of people, I don't think want the nuance or want to like think about it in a critical way. You know what I mean? They want an easy answer. And can you let that person in? You know, racially based targeting is an easy answer. Like it's convenient.
It is. It also doesn't help when it's kind of backtracked slightly, but also when you have like people like Rachel Maddow, who are not really news reporters, like it's more sensationalized now. But like even like when speaking to the Iranian nuclear deal, like calling Iran like an Arab nation. It's not an Arab nation. You know? Like even these like little slip ups in media make the, well, it's not even a little slip up, but like you would perceive it as like a white American, let's say, as like a little slip up, like it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem, and it causes even more problems, and it just perpetuates certain stereotypes and tropes and ideologies that just have no more purpose in 2017. Never had purpose.
Well, I'll push back on that. I agree with everything, and I unite with everything you just said. Except for the last part in terms of like no purpose, because I think like this is the point that like this fear has very, very real implications and very, very like a large purpose actually, as a matter of fact, and that like the creation of the other was such an like basic part of, you know, the justification for settler colonialism and people coming over here and people, you know, colonizing Africa and taking the resources and taking the people as resources. Like the creation of these other things that are not people, they look like people, but they're not people. They're different. They're a threat. They don't like us. They're going to kill us if they get the chance. They're going to take our stuff if they get the chance. The creation of that kind of idea is integral to maintaining the status quo. And as Max was saying, like to the average person, to, you know, whoever's involved, the nuances don't matter. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter that you're, you know, white Jordanian Christian person, you're, or like at least a very, very light-skinned Jordanian Christian person, you're Middle Eastern.
Yeah.
You're coming from a country where there are Middle Eastern terrorists, you know, in the general like idea conceptualization of like this region of the world and the people that come from this region of the world, and therefore you're a threat. Like it doesn't matter what you're attached to. And that like logic and the protection of that logic, like the literal protection of that logic, you know, when people fight back against it, whether verbally or non-verbally, like it's a part of the process to protect that. It's a part of the process to protect whiteness. It's part of the process to justify, you know, the wars. It's a part of the process to justify the toppling of governments and so on and so forth. Like the fear is so much like the fear is like such a big tool and such a big part of it that like, That's the only part I disagreed with what you were saying in terms of the end about their like it not being useful now and not being useful in the future and not having been useful in the past. But like what I'm saying is that like it's the opposite. It was very useful. It's still
it's useful to maintain status quo, but we don't need the status quo. We can't have the status quo as a people.
Agreed.
Yeah.
And we just had Kamal come in to the yurt. Do you want to say hi, Kamal? I cranked it.
I don't know.
We're going to take a cigarette break. Y'all should enjoy this lovely Absol that's about to come on. Drugs.
Wait, first the advertisement, though.
I hate ads, yo. What are ads? Who are ads?
I do like movie ads, though.
Listeners, we will be back at 6:30.
Pow, pow.
Yeah, that bitch, man. Hey, cute motherfucker.
I can't help myself, I think I need some help. I can't help myself, I think I need some help.
Same road.
I can't help myself, I think I need some help.
Say, I love my mama. Lord knows I does. Yeah. I love my family, my cousins, that's my blood. Yeah. I love this music, it comes from up above. Yeah. I love my niggas and I love my bitches. I love everybody that's listening. If you're rich, poor, so what? The whole world we living in, everything that's living in. Trees down to the buzz, can't forget about my blood. It's last but not least, I love drugs.
They say the apple don't fall far from the tree. Yeah. Apple a day, it keep the doctors away. Wonder if my father got motivated to me. But I can't ask him cause the doctors couldn't save him, baby. My mama clean his holy water, hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
We told her whopper since some dirty, yes, this fine to mix with quality tests. We can't find no high tech, I ain't lying, nigga. Axe stashed on the low for the squad full of them coding fiends. OG by the OZ and I still owe the weed man down the street. Monster magic off them Xannies, I might have me one. Mix it with the Sir Kirk on top of that, then I'll be none. If I don't wake up, tell them I love my mama. Lord knows I does. I love my family, my cousins, that's my blood. I love this music, it come from up above. And I love my bitches. I love everybody that's listening. If you're rich or poor, so what? I love the whole world we living in and everything that's living in. And from the trees down to the buzz, can't forget about my blood. Just last but not least, I love drugs. Still coming in. Molly got me rolling, nigga. I got the sniffles, need a box of tissue. Got some issues, I ain't talking about a newspaper. Talking about the issues that come with this new baby. My new bitch in the next room, in the new nigga. Broad day, blinds open, see the view, nigga. Cornea, so scar can't look myself up in the eyes. But if I could, I would say, who was you, nigga? What's become of Herb the third son? Wasn't for these abortions, I'd probably be on my third son. Now it's their decision for the record. Just clearing my conscience, that'll make it better, nigga. No, I know better, nigga. I love my mama, Lord knows I does. I love my family, my cousins, that's my blood. I love this music, it come from up above.
We are back from the cold outside. I was wondering, maybe you wanted to repeat what you were saying out there, and we could talk about it a little bit, if you feel comfortable with that.
Sure. So I guess what I was talking about was related to the conversation before about...
Real quick, you want to introduce yourself to the people?
Oh yeah, my bad. I'm Kamal. I'm a third-year student here at Hampshire. I've been studying mostly bikes and transportation. But yeah, something I was just talking about when we were outside was the notion that when you talk about like what it is to formalize a system of behind like these types of like racial divides, and obviously I'm missing a little bit of the context for the previous conversation, but something that I was talking about and had been writing about recently was how, if you think about especially the way the U.S. Kind of characterized and created its systems, it was talking about, rather than the rhetoric being based on saying that one ethnic group, in particular white, was better than all the rest of them, it always was that the other group, in particular black people or black groups of people, was less than or not equal to. So that you could say at the end of the day, no matter what happened, no matter how successful someone was, no matter how much someone achieved, you could always say at the end of the day, none of these achievements matter, you're still black.
I think that's really interesting, and I wondered if you could speak on like your thoughts on that in relationship to like kind of how in opposite to that, like, the justification for a lot of colonial projects was, like, the white man's burden, you know, the idea that, like, white people are these better people that you need to go out and teach these savages how to live. And, I mean, I know that's, like, ideology to, like, justify colonization, which was for resources, so it's not really actually logical, but, like, I was wondering if you had something to say about that.
Sure. I think that those two kind of play together, is that you first justify to yourself and to those who look like you and those around you that other people are less than equal to you. You can then say, okay, now it is my job, because these people can never attain to my level. I have to go out there and get them as close as they can. I have to go out there and show them how they need to do things in order to be able to get to closer to the position that I'm in. Because even if you look at the way, like, the Irish, for example, were brought into that, like, idea of what whiteness was in the U.S. at one point in time. And obviously this isn't directly related to, like, colonialism in the same way, but even the same mechanics kind of play out in, like, when they go colonialize places like South Africa, for example. They give better political treatments to lighter-skinned South Africans. When they go to North Africa, they give better treatment to lighter-skinned North Africans. So it still kind of applies in the same ways. But when you see those people brought into the group, even the way they're brought in is that, like, you're now better than they are by enough to be included with us. It's not. It's still not that we're better and that our group is better and that this is better. It's this weird, like, you're not as bad now, so we can accept you.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is slightly different, but just to tie it back into the last conversation, I think this plays out in, like, multiple different ways, because it plays out in the domestic front. It plays out in terms of, yeah, that sun is killing me, my God. It plays out in terms of race, but when we talk about sort of the creation of the Arab other, I think that something that's really important in that is the U.S. has always had sort of existential enemies that it's been able to point to as being less than across the world. So at the beginning of the U.S. becoming a global power, you know what I mean? That was Nazi Germany, and it was fascism in Europe. And then after that, you had sort of like the specter of communism and the Soviet Union proliferating throughout the world, which was, again, a justification for a lot of colonial projects, because it was that sort of idea of
this system is less than our system. Democracy is the great thing. This communism, this fascism, this Nazism, this whatever other ism you want to describe is less than equal. It's not as good because other people are doing it. It doesn't work.
Exactly. And after the fall of the Soviet Union in 91, we kind of went through this weird decade in the 90s where we were up on top and there wasn't that existential threat. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't that thing that we could point to in the world in terms of a political system. You know what I mean? Where it's like, this is our target. This is the thing that is less than. And I'm talking about not in terms of, like, I guess domestic ideology, but in terms of, like, kind of like what the state posits itself as. And I think that the thing that has filled that void now is this Islamophobia. It is this creation of the Islamic other. And it's this politicization of Islam that happens in this country, you know what I mean? The idea that, you know, all Muslims want to come to this country and, like, implement Sharia, like, you know, in the States or something like that.
There's so many different ways to practice being a Muslim.
Exactly.
We can even just describe just one difference being there are black Muslims in this country who have no tie to any type of Islam or Muslim religion outside of this country.
Exactly. No, but I think it just speaks to the importance of this construction of the other for the identity of, you know, the U.S., but sort of more in general, I think, either, like, whiteness or the colonizer state, like, depending on if you want to look at it, like, on terms of the individual or in terms of systems, you know what I mean? But I don't really know where I'm going with this. I just wanted to try to tie it back.
I think, I mean, you know, continuing our discussion of, like, the Middle East, continuing our discussion of, you know, the politics of the creation of blackness, the politics of the creation of whiteness, and kind of around the same subject line that I was talking about like the way in which this new Islamophobic movement throughout white nations, you know, with the Brexit, with our Muslim ban, with Europe's general, you know, straight up racist, violent protests targeting Muslims in France, in Germany, in Italy, in Greece. I'm really noticing, like, a straight up racialization of the, like, Muslim identity in a very, very similar way that, like, Judaism was racialized in Nazi Germany. And, like, Judaism as Judaism has generally been racialized. Jewish people in Europe were not white. They were they were Jewish. They were some other class of people, and they were treated as such. And to me, that's the politics of racialization is the politics of creating blackness. To white people, to whoever identifies themselves as white, whether or not you think it like consciously or subconsciously, you have some sort of understanding. You were raised with some sort of understanding that your whiteness is better than blackness, that blackness is inherently inferior to whiteness. And you might, you know, not agree with this like consciously. You might very much disagree with this consciously and actively work to never reproduce that kind of dynamic in your life. But that doesn't change the fact that you were raised as white. You understand yourself as white. You ingested white media. You ingested racist, anti-black notions throughout your whole life. And I think this is playing out in the racialization of Muslim people in terms of Islamophobia. Now, there are very, very many different dynamics between the racialization of Jewish people in Nazi Germany and the racialization of, you know, Muslim people in the United States today. One, namely, you know, the literal sheer quantity of quote-unquote Muslims in the world. Like, there's 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. Like, you're not going to get rid of them. I don't know.
No, it's true. And also, it's a matter, it's not a matter of, but also, I mean, often I hear money thrown around in this too. Like Semitic people and money. And I remember when Trump was elected, and I was, honestly, I'm a white girl, and I was scared because I'm a Jew. I'm really serious. Like, for a hot second there, I was scared. Like, selfishly so, because that's not what's at the forefront right now. But for a hot second, I was there, you know, to be very, very transparent with you all. And someone said to me that it's okay because Jews have money. And I said, but they had money in Poland.
Hashtag not all Jews.
Oh, God, I don't even...
It's real, though. It didn't help in all of these countries where that, like, even, like, where that notion comes from is something that comes from the countries that the Holocaust took place in. It's like, people had, like you said, they had money in Poland. They had been in banking. The whole reason we have that notion of, like, Jews have money is because in Europe that's what they were relegated to doing because they weren't given other jobs. So it was like, mm-hmm. No one wants to touch the bank, so we'll send the Jews to do it. That's literally what happened. That's how that notion comes up. Mm-hmm. And it didn't save anyone that they were dealing with the money, that they were running the banks. If anything, it was one of the points that Hitler made about why Jews needed to be gotten rid of, as he was saying things like, oh, they're managing all our money. They've been, like, going behind the back doors and, like, stealing interest from us and, like, doing all this stuff that really wasn't happening, but that didn't save anyone, like you said.
It's just really interesting, though, because, like, you think it all has to do with capitalism, and it is. It is. A lot of it is capitalism, for sure. But also, if money doesn't help you in these situations, like, what is it really? Money can be an out for individuals, but for an entire group of people? Like, I don't know if you have any thoughts to that, but...
Yeah, I can definitely speak to that. It's one of those contradictions of capitalism that, like, some people often use as a critique of, you know, communist rhetoric, socialist rhetoric, you know, anti-capitalist rhetoric in general. The idea that, like, that kind of went off on the wrong train. I was thinking of something else. That's not what I was trying to say. What I was trying to say is that you're right. Money doesn't save people. Rich black people get stopped by the police and get arrested and get murdered. Rich brown people get the same treatment. Your lived reality, lived political reality, the way in which society treats you, the way in which society views you, that can slightly shift when you have funds, when you have, like, the resource of money. But money isn't inherently power, and people think that money is inherently power. And in capitalism teaches everybody to understand money equals power. Money is a resource that is directly correlated to power. If I have money, I can make things move that live, you know, across the world for me. If I have money, I can make people do things for me that, like, a lot of people wouldn't really be willing to do. But the thing about money within capitalism is that it's just a piece of paper. Like, that's the thing. Like, it's a representation of the resources. It's supposed to be like an IOU note that says, like, this IOU note isn't, like, relates to gold or resources, however you want to picture them. But unless you actually have the physical resource, you don't have anything. Like, you can have bucket loads of money, and that doesn't stop people with guns from coming to get you.
Yeah, I think an important part of this too is, like, you have to ask yourself, like, what is the capitalist system that we're talking about built to maintain? Because it's not necessarily built to maintain itself. It's built to maintain certain structures of power, and it's built to keep certain groups of people in power. And as long as those groups of people are not being threatened, then yes, like money can be power for any individual, you know what I mean? But when it comes to what we're talking about now, and what we're talking about now is sort of this creation of the political other that acts as a tool for people to, you know, be able to stay in power and for the status quo to continue, like that Trump, that, not to, that trumps any consideration of like what the system nominally sets out to be. Because what the system actually sets out to be is an insurance for those in power to stay in power. You know what I mean? And they don't really give a fuck about anything else except for that. And if that means, you know, stripping rich people of their, you know, rich black people or rich brown people, like, of certain rights, you know what I mean? Or persecuting them, that it just doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of it's a non-starter almost, like.
Also, if you take it to perhaps one of its more extremes, if you look at some of the, like, Eastern Bloc nations and the way that, like, everything fell kind of after World War II, basically money stopped mattering. And people had lots of wealth before that point in time. But after that, people just literally changed the way they changed what notes were being printed, what notes had value. I mean, that's part of why, like, Germany had the problems that it did at the time, is that their money was literally more useful as firewood than it was as a spending material. And that was simply something that happened kind of arbitrarily, because other countries in the World War II basically just, World War I basically just decided to say, you know what, German labor, not worth as much now, because y'all did this thing called World War I. So at any given moment, anyone who has that power, whether they be a state that controls X number of actual labor, or whether it be who's in charge of the IMF or the World Bank or whatever that organization is, you can mobilize that power that you actually have over whatever the money looks like from whatever position, if you're actually in the real position of power to be able to change the actual resources. Because like Med said, having money doesn't guarantee you control over that resource, because that money itself can be completely devalued tomorrow for all you care.
I think that example of Germany after World War One is like super poignant, because I mean, I think pretty much since the beginning, like, Germans have been considered white and, like, considered a part of this, like, European Westernness. Go for it.
I'd just like to jump in. The Germans were the first white people. Like, according to history, according to colonialism, Germany was the first, like, nation to get together and build a, like, national identity on a sort of, like, ethnocentric, like, nationalist identity. The idea that, like, we're all one sort of ethnicity, and, you know, the French are kind of a little further off ethnicity, and the Britons are, like, a little further off ethnicity, but, like, basically we're all the same ethnicity, and that, like, all the other folks, they're literally a different species. And so the creation of the German state in that way was the first instance of the creation of the white man. They were the ones who split up Africa. They had that Berlin conference that, like, began the colonial project. So, like, Germany is the start of whiteness.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I mean, I think it's interesting, because what they threatened in, I guess, like, World War One, you know what I mean, is this sort of like what we call now, like, the quote-unquote liberal world order, but essentially, like, the colonial world order, you know what I mean? And, like, that's the shit you get punished for. Like, when you come for people, you know, Western countries' access to resources, or Western countries', like, ability to exploit, like, it don't matter who you are, you know what I mean? Like, you're getting the shit under that stick. I don't know.
I think also in this conversation, it's important to realize that we often frame it as how it plays out, like, in the U.S.'s, like, influence over in other places. But kind of like you said, that was, that, like, this whole idea is really, like, Germany's thing. It's been a thing in, like, Germany for, some could argue the conversation started even as much as, like, 10 or 15, 20 years before World War One even happened. You start to see some of the, like, because it's not like the people who had that rhetoric had it just from the blue one day. They would just woke up and said, hey, you know what we should do? We should just, like, make up what it is to be white and then say everyone's not as good, and then we're just going to just tell everyone that and, like, just going to work. Like, there's documents about parts of that plan and parts of that colonial system that Napoleon has part in. There's parts that so many people throughout, I mean, you could even argue that some parts of what King Leopold did well before that in terms of, like, extorting resources from the middle of, like, Central Africa is also involved in that. And I think also remembering that one of the largest places of where resources went is the Netherlands. Not England, not the United States, but the Netherlands drew the most resources because King Leopold went so hard that literally, first of all, he's not even actually the king, But second, the actual king said, wait a second, this is extortion on a level we can't allow. We're going to remove you from power, replace all the people you hired and all the people you were employing, and reorganize this because you're actually going to kill all the people in this country. You're going to starve them all to death. You're going to create a desert where there was no desert before in your lifetime. That's what happened, and that's what stopped him. Someone else said, you're going too far.
Kind of talking about your point about pre-World War I Germany, and like the idea that like it was even a couple of decades before World War I that this idea of whiteness was created. It literally was. Like, Germany's colonies were confiscated after they lost World War I. Like, they didn't have the Congo anymore. They didn't have, you know, those access to those resources. So the creation of the German national identity, the creation of the white national identity that, like, allowed for a colonial project to be even thought of as possible, that was formulated, as you said, like, literally decades before World War I even happened. And, like, in thinking of, like, the Jewish Holocaust during World War II, and, like, why it's so, like, why we all had to learn about it, why we all, like, have some sort of understanding of, like, who Hitler was since preschool and, like, what he did and how he's a terrible person, is because Jewish people that, like... I'm not going to start there. For the most part, contemporary and within that time period, Jewish people were understood as like light-skinned people. Like, you, when you think of a Jewish person in your head, like, stereotypically, the first thing, couple things that come to mind are, I mean, not the first couple things. Like, one of the things, characteristics that comes to mind is like light skin, like almost white. Maybe possibly a little tan, because, you know, some of y'all are Middle Eastern. But, like, for the most part, like, light skin is an attribute that's associated stereotypically with Jewish people. And because that's a factor, you got to look at, like, whose death and whose mass murder is humanized. Because, you know, Kamal mentioned King Leopold II, but I didn't learn about King Leopold II in, you know, preschool, middle school, high school. I learned about
Fact that indefinitely more people died.
Like, literally more people, like, tens more millions of people died before the Jewish Holocaust. So, like, the idea of whose death on a mass scale is actually worth remembering is inherently tied into who's humanized and who can be humanized. And that is also inherently tied into who has the proximity to this whiteness.
But here's the loophole. Stalin's Leningrad. Mm-hmm. Over 20 million people died. Mm-hmm. Like, over 20 million people. And we see Russia and the Soviet Union at the time as, like, a white nation, right? Even though, like, half of it resides in Asia, too. I mean, am I right? Do you also...
I mean, they were an ally during World War II, you know, when that happened.
But that's something that I know very little about, you know? But how do I know very... And you know, like, I've heard of, like, King Leopold, and I've learned a bit. But I've never in my life... And, like, I totally agree with everything you both, all three of you, have said. But how have I not heard about the massacre and the death of over 20 million people? In Soviet Russia.
Because these memories are selective, you know what I mean? Like, they're massacres like that are only remembered if they serve a political purpose. I think specifically something important to touch on in terms of the remembrance of the Holocaust is also because the U.S.'s position in the world is inextricably tied to its victory in World War II and the destruction of Western Europe as well that left us sort of as the only industrial power, you know what I mean? This was the moment that created patriotic nationalism in the United States on the global scale that we understand it now. You know what I mean? And the enemy in that struggle which created that nationalism is Nazism. So therefore, the evils of Nazism, you know what I mean, are sort of like the antithesis to what it means to be American in that patriotic notion. I think that that's really important. But something going back to what you were saying about the loss of, like, the German colonial empire before World War One, and how that sort of, like, or no, after World War One, and how that fueled the rise of nationalism going into World War Two. I think it's interesting to think about the decline of U.S. power, especially since the end of, or since the beginning of the Iraq War, and sort of, like, the failure that our Middle Eastern campaigns have become in the 21st century. I mean, you can call the Gulf Wars failures in some right, because they didn't really do anything, but it's not as visible a failure as Iraq and Afghanistan have been. But I think that that can be inextricably tied to the surge in nationalism that we see now in this country, this idea that the world is sort of like once was in our grasp and now is slipping from our grasp. So we have to do something to take it back. But I'd be curious to hear what you have to think about that.
I think to start with, it would be important to kind of make a distinction on the intended effect of those campaigns. because while it's easy to definitely label them militaristically as a failure,
Are you talking about Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah. Okay. I think if you think about what's really going on in terms of that, that's like a major land grab, and the whole purpose isn't necessarily to militaristically win, because realistically speaking, you're not going to win a desert fight, like, as like a military standard. Like, that's just not going to happen. You're not going to go into a desert, fight a fight, and win the fight, and say, congratulations, I took over a desert. That's not really what the goal is.
To be fair, point of clarification, Afghanistan is not
a desert. Well, yeah, Afghanistan is not a desert.
I get what you're
saying. But also, Afghanistan has never been successfully invaded either,
also
ever
true.
In the history.
Yeah. And the Taliban now holds more territory in Afghanistan than it did before our invasion, which
also
is interesting.
True.
But, sorry.
But the point either still, but I think that kind of instability, and that's what I was kind of getting at, creating that kind of instability was really the point. It's to create a system where governments can't really become stable so that you can force people to still look at you as you're this important power. Because if you think about what's mm-hmm. really been going on is that alongside of this, you see the U.S. bolstering its military presence in a lot of other places and really kind of expanding the number of bases that exist elsewhere mm-hmm. and kind of moving, kind of like in the early 90s and late 80s, jump into this like conflict, and then they center everything like conversationally around this conflict happening in a very similar way to what you could argue with what Trump is doing now in terms of like what he chooses to tweet and talk about and like make publicly more noticeable. Meanwhile, there's a whole bunch of backdoor dealing going on, bills being proposed now, but back then it was, and over that time span, it's, oh yeah, we're not going to send more troops to our active conflicts, but we are going to send more troops to our bases that aren't in conflict.
Yeah, no, I definitely get what you're saying. And I think just to illustrate your point, you know what I mean? Like, if it wasn't for U.S. forces in Afghanistan right now, the government in Kabul would have collapsed. You know, the state as it exists in Afghanistan is completely dependent at this point on U.S. security forces, or else they would be overrun. It's the same in Iraq in their fight against ISIS. Because, I mean, we took Iraq, and there's as many ISIS fighters in Iraq as there are in Syria. I mean, militaristically, it's been a failure, but in terms of keeping the U.S. military in the region, it's been a total success, which is what you've been saying. And it's also, I mean, not to go down like a whole rabbit hole, but I feel like the way that we have conducted those conflicts has very much allowed for us to expand into a lot of other places that aren't talked about a lot, like drone wars in Pakistan, drone wars in Yemen and Libya, that the U.S. public just doesn't care about. You know what I mean? They just, and again, I think it goes back to this creation of the other. It's, you know, we have these advanced targeting systems. We have this ability to bomb people, you know, while they're, you know, sitting in a bathroom and like float a hellfire through their window or something like that. They must be bad. Where, you know what I mean? The U.S. military is too technology advanced to target people who aren't bad. And what you've seen under that is a proliferation of targeted killings sort of across the entire Middle East by the U.S.
To bring that back to also what Lena was talking about, how you'd never heard about some of the like different like the fact that there in Leningrad, there Stalingrad, there had been 20 million people who died, and just that was never brought up. And I think kind of related to both of those is the fact of like who's actually writing the history. It's written by people who have won the fight. It's written by people who aren't on the losing side of it. Not to say like there's clear winners and losers all the time necessarily, but it's written by the group of people that has the power to be able to influence what is the understanding of what that event is. And if you think about coming out of that part, out of either of those events, like on the side of like those 20 million people, they were 20 million people who predominantly were not white, quote unquote, or white appearing Russian people. There were a lot of people from the fact Russia spans literally from the westernmost edge of Eastern Europe straight through to the other side of the Asian continent. Everyone there isn't white. And a lot of the people that died in those types of things weren't necessarily expressly white. But yet and still, that's their lives still have value. The fact that 20 million people died still has value. And I think, talking about what Max said about how being able to be in these areas of Afghanistan and Iraq gives you access to being able to do things in Pakistan. We don't talk, and like talking about like Hellfire missiles being able to like be accurate or however accurate they are to like target specific people, but we don't talk about the inaccuracy with which they're actually used. We don't talk about the fact that people are just kind of like, yeah, that's a block, it's fine, we can just hit the whole block. The missile might be accurate enough to target one particular person, but it's still a bomb, and it's still going to destroy more than just the one building.
I was watching this. This is a little bit of a tangent.
I'm sorry, Lanes. I don't want to interrupt and be that person, but we do have 5 more minutes on the air, and this is Fascism Red Alert, and I do have a question for all of our guests, so I would really appreciate it if y'all could answer this question for me. So, if you were presented with the option of ascribing to a political regime, like literally buying into a state, like you become a citizen of this state, the state, the sole thing that the state recognizes is your humanity and works to allow you to exist based on that fact. But the state is fascist. Would you or would you not join, reject, attempt to destroy, organize against, not feel any type of way? What are your thoughts?
I'm wondering if it's a contradiction to be fascist and yet promote humanity and like and value humanity.
Tell me more.
I'm literally, this is a train of thought I'm just having right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty organic. Because I feel like inherently in some fascist regimes, it's about one person. It's about the person in charge. And if you value humanity, it's not about one person. It's an entity, you know? And I'm not trying, because it's a, like, the question you're asking is really great and it's really important, but for me to answer, I feel like it contradicts itself. But if in this context, in that it does, this fascist dictator does in fact value humanity, I would have to see, you know? So that, I mean, that being said, I don't know if I'd buy into it, but I'd wait before resisting. I don't know.
It's a good answer. No wrong answer.
I think that's an interesting question, because if you look at the example of Yugoslavia post-World War II, there you see actually what looks like an effective fascism. You have a dictator who exists and is in power and actually brings economic benefit to all of the people and all of the citizens. Everyone, he keeps saying, I'll step down now, and everyone just kind of goes, now we're good. We'll just keep doing what you're doing. It's going to work. So I think it doesn't inherently have to be a contradiction, but I think given the types of conditions that set up for fascists to be able to operate and like win and hold the positions they do, it often will end up being a contradiction because like Lena said, it will end up just being more often than not about that person and about their goals and about their vision for their people. And it won't really be centered on actually concern for all of the humans who are actually involved in that state.
Like, what's their definition of humanity, you know?
Exactly.
And like, who is humanity? Is it outside the borders of this one nation? Or does it stretch across the ocean to all the other continents? I mean, I think that's important for me to answer that question too.
What was the question?
The question is the question I will always be asking on Fascism Red Alert from this point forward to all of our guests, and that is, if you were presented with the option of joining a political regime, a state, and a place with a government and a, you know, land and rules and laws, and the one, you know, the one thing that this state agrees to is that it sees you as a part of the state, as a human, as humane, and that based on that recognition, it has to provide the basic things that humans require. The catch is the state's fascist.
And the question was, do you support it? Do you try to resist it? Or where do you come at it?
We've had this conversation multiple times. My hesitance in this is, in an abstract world, if we're talking about this in a vacuum, obviously, if there was some sort of authoritarian government that genuinely, you know, cared for the human rights of everybody across the world, sort of like irregardless of class or race or any other like identifying factor, I mean, sure, yeah, I'd be on board with it. But the problem to me in practice is, power corrupts people. And I think going back to the conversation that we were having earlier about the creation of the other, I mean, it's sort of an inextricable part of the creation of a state is that you have an enemy. And I don't really understand how a state like that, you know, maybe nominally or rhetorically, the enemy is quote unquote evil people, which would be defined as people who don't necessarily recognize everybody as human. But the problem is when you talk about that, when that becomes institutionalized, when any kind of other becomes institutionalized like that, you start painting people with a really broad brush. And that's the thing that scares me. And when you give, you know, by definition, fascist or authoritarian governments just have an incredible amount of centralized power. And I'm just very hesitant to give any system control over human beings in that sort of absolute way. But that being said, we are out of time at this point, so.
And that was our fourth episode, third episode of fourth episode of Fascism Red Alert. Thank you to our loyal viewers who made it through the whole thing. We really appreciate you. Thank you to Leans and Kamal for coming on the show. You know, y'all were great. We really appreciate it. And we're gonna close out with a little J. Cole, y'all. Everybody dies.
Yeah, we back in Muhammad crib, nigga, top floor, in the back room with just one little small window, nigga. The light be coming through it in the morning.